This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. A recent New York Times piece documented a phenomenon in American society, the disappearance of young black men. These missing men are lost to premature death or incarceration at rates much higher than their white counterparts or African-American female peers. The particulars of these disappearances are complex and varied, but today we start our conversation by taking a look at one man's individual story. Dwayne Betts was an honor student in Maryland when he committed a carjacking that landed him in prison for more than 8 years. He spent a total of 2 of those years in solitary confinement. Dwayne went on to become an author and award-winning poet. He serves on the President's Coordinating Council on Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, and he's currently a law student at Yale University, and he joins me from the campus of Yale University now. Dwayne Betts, welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks for having me.
By all accounts, you were a good student, a promising student as a young man in Maryland. Tell us about growing up and your community growing up.
I guess I would probably just say it was like growing up in most communities. I think now that I reflect on it, maybe 20 years removed, I feel like even in my own head, I guess I expected to get in some kind of trouble because I was doing some things I had sort of no business doing. But it was a regular community. So if I tried to parse it out, like if I look at it, did I expect the community to lead me to go to prison? That's not really the answer I would give. I mean, when I was 16, I kind of expected to go to college. And so the bigger issue for me is like what happened where my own expectations for myself weren't really reflected, and maybe my teacher's expectations for me and some people around me what their expectations were, and really the availability of certain options.
Well, something did happen, and as you say, you weren't quite expecting it, but you did carjack someone, and then were sent to prison. What led to that decision? What was happening that day?
You know, I try to explain it. I think the best way for me to explain it is really to say, you know, you had the sort of possibilities that surrounded me, and there were a lot of possibilities that surrounded me that were towards the negative, and so I was exposed. This is actually mind-boggling to me now, since I have a 7-year-old. But the first time I heard about a carjacking, I probably was 12 years old, and I was a 7th grader. And it was, you know, somebody in the neighborhood just telling me the story, and the guy probably was 17 or 18. And I say that just to say that I lived in a community where some things weren't right, but they were regular. And from that time when I was 12 to the time when I was 16, I went through a number of phases where I still sort of didn't expect to get in trouble, but I would get exposed more and more. And by the time I was 16, sometimes you jump out the window and you don't really know why you did it. And it's hard to even talk about it without feeling like you're making an excuse. But it just seems like to say something that's like a cliche, it almost seems like a rite of passage.
Mm. But it didn't seem, at the time, it didn't strike you as a rite of passage. In other words, you didn't, or did you, feel like this is something you had to do to prove yourself? You know, I mean, I don't hear you saying that.
Yeah, right. No, because it wasn't really about proving myself. It was sort of like you don't join a basketball team to prove yourself. It's just some people find themselves surrounded by certain options, and some people find themselves surrounded by other options. And so it just ended up being, sadly, one of those things I did. And the reason why that's an unsatisfying explanation is because nobody wants to imagine a world in which picking up a gun and carjacking somebody is regular. But I actually lived in a community where, at least for me, for that one night, a bunch of forces combined together, and that was just what happened.
And you'd never been arrested before. This was when you got arrested for this crime. You'd never been arrested before, right?
I'd never been arrested. I never picked up a gun before. But I also went to a high school in which 3 of my classmates got killed. You know, I went to the high school in which, you know, people were being tried as adults for murder and other felonies, and nobody was talking about what it actually meant. You know, I went to a high school in which the expectation wasn't necessarily that we would go to prison, but we lived in a climate and an environment in which these things were happening every day, and nobody was confronting what it meant.
So when you went to jail, obviously, and court, I think you pled guilty. Well, what did you think the punishment would be?
Well, I was tried as an adult, so I understood that carjacking carried life in Virginia. I didn't expect to get life. I actually didn't expect to get any time. I mean, I had my high school diploma, so I thought, it was a smack in the face. You know, I was pleading guilty because I understood that I was dead wrong. But, prison is a hard place. So I guess at 16 and 120 pounds, I thought I might get a year, 2 years, 3 years. You know, I really couldn't conceptualize what it meant to spend time in prison. And so I just definitely didn't think I would go to prison with adults. I didn't think I would be in super maximum security prisons. I didn't think I would spend my first 10 days at a jail in solitary confinement. Like, I had no conception of what it meant to be forgotten. And I think, you know, we were talking about the New York Times piece and being disappeared. I mean, to me, I hear it in two ways. It's just the notion of actually being gone, but it's the notion of what it means to be gone and you actually are still somewhere. So I was in solitary confinement in a jail, and that place existed, but nobody cared. Nobody thought about it. And even a judge, when he sentenced me, he told me, I'm under no illusion that sending you to prison would help, but you could get something out of it if you want. And so it was for me, it was a tension and trying to take responsibility for my actions, but also trying to confront the injustice of being in a place where, like, nobody expected me to survive, let alone thrive.
So what impact does that have on you? You talk about being disappeared from a community. We'll talk later about how this affects communities. But for you to be suddenly gone from the scene, but somewhere, as you say, somewhere that's very dangerous, what impact was that having on you psychologically, emotionally?
I guess I just have a gap in my experience. You know, I think of it in two ways. I mean, I still grew up around a bunch of black men. And I think what it did for me is it made me view and think about justice and injustice in a different way. And also, it's just very complicated. You know, you ask what the source is or why did I commit my crime? And few of us have answers as solid as that. You know, and it almost forces you to go back. And for me, it forces me to go back not to December 7th when I committed my crime, but maybe to 2 or 3 years before when I first heard about somebody being carjacked, or to a year before when somebody in my class tried to carjack somebody. You know, it makes me think about what the response was to those incidents and how those responses didn't really force me to think about the world that I was existing in and how possible it was to disappear.
Well, tell me more about that, those responses, as you think back to the first time you heard about somebody else carjacking. What was going through your mind? How much of that did you think was ever a possibility for you?
I read Nathan McCall's book when I was in the ninth grade. You know, so I was fully aware of the fact that a lot of black men were in prison. I was fully aware of the fact that it was a huge possibility, but I wasn't aware of it in a way in which it was changing my everyday actions. I wasn't aware of it in a way in which it was kind of influencing the conversations that I had with the adults around me. And so again, I think one of the reasons why we cycling around the same questions is because we sort of, at least when I was a child, I understood what was happening in the world, but I wasn't engaging in a way with the world to make me really think about the decisions that I made that could lead me down certain paths or down other options.
As you said, you were a good student or a promising student up until then. Now you're in prison. And it seems that that's where you really started to take your education a little more seriously. You talk about reading in a new way and where perhaps somebody took a different interest in you. Talk about that experience and how you approached education once you were in prison.
Yeah, I should say two things. So one, it was just me on an individual level. And I think the only way that I felt like I could change my life and think about how I would live in the future was to approach it on an individual level. So I couldn't really comprehend what it meant to be tried as an adult and the injustice of being tried as an adult in the same way. And I couldn't make that my challenge as a 16-year-old. You know, as a 16-year-old, my challenge was, one, to survive prison, and then, two, to develop some kind of skill set that I could take home with me. And I just wanted to be a writer. And I felt like, you know, being a writer was the one thing that you could do while in prison. And I just approached it as if I was already at the bottom. Nobody could ever question, you know, my toughness. Nobody could ever question my foolishness. Nobody could really say anything about me. I mean, I'd already been the worst. And so it was easy for me to just imagine climbing up from there. And to be perfectly honest, like I was more equipped, I think, than a lot of people because I had been doing well in school. And so at least I had the training to be able to train myself. And there were a few people who took me under their wing. The first person was the GED teacher, who, when I told her that I was taking French 4 and AP US History and pre-calculus in high school, she looked at me as if I didn't belong in jail. And that was the first time really that a person like a teacher looked at me as if, even in my failure, they expected something different. And she laid the way for me to graduate from high school. I ended up graduating a year early. But I say all of that to say that, you know, prison was the moment in which, one, I realized that I could be more. And I realized that, you know, being more was more than just saying you wanted to be more. And two, I met a couple of people who looked at me like they expected something besides, you know, a state number.
Was this the first time you considered yourself as a writer or a potential writer?
Yeah, before prison, I tell my mom all the time, before prison, I intended on being an engineer, and I had it all mapped out. I was good at math, and but I mean, I got locked up, and I was 16, and I knew I had 9 years to do, and so I just decided to be a writer.
What was it that, why did you change? What was it about literature that, why did you change your mind?
I was always a reader. Maybe this is the thing. I was in solitary confinement at the jail when I was 16 just because they didn't have a place for me in population. And the one book they gave me was this book of short stories by James Baldwin. And, you know, James Baldwin is wrestling with all of these questions that we're dealing with now. And I think just the acute way in which he was addressing racial violence, addressing society, made me feel really as if I don't know, this probably, again, sounds corny, but it made me feel like I abandoned some responsibility that I had, and I just decided that it was that book, and then the first book I read cover to cover was A Lesson Before Dying by Ernest Gaines, and it was sort of those two books that made me feel like, I don't know, maybe I had abandoned some birthright, and I sort of really brought shame to my mom. So, you know, that was a really personal decision, and I think for me it's hard to talk about really personal decisions in this larger context because it makes it look like, yeah, I'm blaming the victim, right, or blaming myself, but that's the reality of it.
We'll continue the conversation with Duane Betts, a graduate of the MFA program at Warren Wilson College. We're talking today about the missing black man on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Across the nation, more than 1.5 million black men are missing from everyday life, according to a recent New York Times piece. In North Carolina, more than 70,000 missing African-American men. So what do we mean by missing? Well, this is the term used to describe the difference in African-American male population for ages 25 to 54 as compared to black female populations of the same age. Typically, this disappearance results from incarceration or premature death. Joining me to talk about the phenomenon is Wisdom Powell. She's a professor of health behavior at UNC School of Public Health. Her research focuses on the physical and mental health of African-American men. Wisdom Powell, welcome back to the State of Things. Good to have you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Also, Mark Anthony Neal, a professor of African and African-American studies at Duke University. His work centers on black popular culture and black masculinity. Welcome back, Mark.
How you doing, Frank?
And still with us is Duane Betts. He was incarcerated for more than 8 years for a carjacking that he committed as a teenager. He's a poet, he's an author, and currently a law student at Yale. Wisdom Powell, you look at the missing black man, this phenomenon that we're calling the missing black man, from a health perspective, complex issue. What do you see are the prominent health issues facing African-American men?
Well, I mean, the first to start with is the fact that when we look at just basic mortality data, we see black men still living the shortest lives of all individuals from all other race sex groups in the United States. And that is despite the fact that across the population, we're seeing a diminishment in the gap in life expectancy between men and women. But this gap is diminishing at a much slower pace for black males. Now, as we've already talked about, when we think about, you know, diminished life expectancy, there are many factors that could contribute to that. But when we think about this from a perspective of population health, we see some patterns, both in exposure to high violence, crime, alcohol, and drugs, but also we see differences in the rates of early detection and prevention of chronic diseases. So there's a sort of wicked problem that's created both by exposure to things in the environment, but also healthcare access factors that shape the outcomes of these men and boys.
And these are across the economic spectrum in African-American communities. And I've also seen research that compares African male populations to African-American. This really is a phenomenon in African-American society, or among African-American men.
Yes, and I think that gets us back to the fact that these issues are really a product of social systems and social structural issues, that if were it just, you know, a matter of biology or biological sort of vulnerability, then we would see these patterns across men from the same patterns across men from all other race sex groups, but that's not the case. So there is something social in nature that is driving these outcomes. So where Black men and boys live, play, work, and get health care play a considerable role in determining how long they live and the quality of life they have while living.
So, and as we said, and we're going to say it about 1,000 times in this program, it's complex. There are a lot of factors involved. How much of it has to do with behavior, behaviors, and how much of it has to do with sort of the place where environmental factors over which one might not have much control?
And so I like to always think about behaviors as a byproduct of sort of interactions with the social context. And I don't think that people, that behaviors are necessarily just, you know, the outcome of what you think rationally, what you do individually. They are created, in fact, by context and circumstance. So, yes, when we look at, you know, the distribution of causes for these kinds of disparities, we see a great bit of that being defined or sort of caused, quote unquote, by behaviors that men engage in. But those behaviors are often a response to social structures and conditions that actually make those behaviors the most likely and rational response. So, for example, for men who are exposed to race-related stress, we see a significant increase in risk-taking behaviors, so such that men are more likely to use substances, are more likely to respond to stress in ways that actually bring put them in situations that would increase their likelihood of being confronting social justice systems and or criminal justice systems.
And this correlation is so strong that it's actually caused you to create a research study now to look at just that. Maybe you can describe the study for
sure.
us, because I think it points to correlations that are already out there that are pretty strong and demand more research.
Absolutely. So we're now doing a project called Manhoods that is really focused on trying to identify factors within neighborhoods that actually condition the kinds of behaviors that we know lead to the missingness that we're talking about. And so we're trying to capture the exposure that young Black males between the ages of 18 and 29 face to racial profiling. So how often are Black males stopped in any given period of the day or over the course of a week, which is what we're studying. And we want to look at the stress response in real time. Like if you're stopped and frisked, what do you do in response to that? Who do you talk to about it? And what are the implications when you don't share it with anybody or you stuff down your emotions about it? Are there behavioral and then, of course, other kinds of negative health repercussions of that? And we think that by understanding that pattern of behavior and the influence of environment on those behaviors, that we might be able to develop more responsive interventions, both at the policy and at the public health level.
And Mark Anthony Neal, another dynamic in all of this, of course, is popular culture and the way we create culture, then respond to culture, and the way the images that are created by these cultures have an impact on our impressions and the way we behave. So talk about that in terms of popular culture and this phenomenon of the missing Black man with respect to pop culture.
I think it absolutely contributes to this idea that Black men are a problem, and society has generally dealt with Black men in terms of Black men and boys in terms of problem frame, something that has to be dealt with, something that's dealt with in terms of punitive strategies, incarceration, et cetera, other forms of police and stopping frisk. I think one of the dangers, of course, is that one of the best things to address kind of the overdetermination of how we view Black masculinity. You know, for some folks, they hear missing Black men and they're looking at LeBron and they're looking at Jay-Z and they're looking like looking at Barack Obama. And they're like, what are you talking about? And I think one of the things that occurs with the absence is that folks don't actually have more contact with actual Black men and the diversity of Black men that exists within Black communities. So on the one hand, you know, folks don't want to hear about the absence because Black men are a problem. But at the same time, folks are going, what is the problem? Right. Obviously, they have not made the right kind of life choices. So that even someone who might be viewed in his earlier career as problematic like Jay-Z has been able to get on a right path, right? Or Barack Obama being another example of that. And so I think that's one of the dangers, right? We don't get to see everyday Black men and the kind of everyday struggles that they have so often in terms of American society. When we think about Black men, you know, they're either subhuman or superhuman. You know, the regular dudes who go to work every day, who actually are engaged with raising their children, who are in the supermarket, you know, buying groceries. We never see those dudes. But those are also the same dudes who are dealing with the type of stress and other kind of trauma that Dr. Powell's talking about.
So we got these very different perceptions, right, if you're living in white communities, particularly the growing segregated communities that we're finding more and more these days, your only exposure to black masculinity would be through pop culture.
Right, absolutely.
And Dwayne Betts, you talked about having options available to you that people in those white communities may never have considered, like carjacking, things that are actual possibilities in your mind because they exist in your community, though not in your early life. Those are possibilities that many people in those communities would never entertain. Is that Dwayne Betts?
You know, I would say that. And also, I would say what I was just thinking about listening to Mark talk is that, you know, all of the small things that happen in the individual's life sort of get ignored based on the huge things that happen. So I remember being sort of suspended 5 times in 8th grade, having never gotten a fight and only being suspended for back talk. I remember having in-school suspension a number of times. And so how those experiences both framed the way that the teachers around me and the community around me responded to my presence, and how that also changed the way I responded to the options around me. So I think, you know, it's both what you said and this other layer of, yes, I had those options, but it's almost as if not that I was pushed into those options, but that those became the fallback.
Yeah,
the fallback decision.
You know, and we can get very personal. We're going to make this point too, that everybody's situation is unique. But I read in one of your memoirs and interviews where your mother was getting calls just about every day from the school about your smart mouth and back talk, and it just triggered a thought, because my mother tells the same story about me in 3rd grade every day. She got a call from the nuns about how bad I was. It was not a possibility that I would be suspended. It never occurred to anybody in the entire 8 years of my troubled career in elementary school. But was not. And so here's, I mean, these are sort of minute differences that now that we're talking about zero tolerance policies, structural things that lead to these much narrower bouquet of outcomes, right? A platform of outcomes that make it pretty hard to escape these kinds of possibilities. Not impossible, but difficult.
It's almost as if they're, you know, some of the schools are using these kind of broken window strategies that we've seen in policing for the last 25 years. They're applying them, you know, to schools, right? And of course, we've been critical of that in terms of public schools. We're also starting to see those kinds of practices and what was supposed to be a safe haven for our kids in terms of charter schools. But you see kids who are feeling criminalized, right, over everyday kinds of things that 12, 13, 14, year-old kids do, and also being self-aware that the black kids and brown kids are being policed in the kind of way where the concern is so much more that they will grow up to be productive citizens that follow directions, you know, as opposed to thinkers, right? Critical thinkers who can think outside of a box, who can draw outside the line. They can perceive that their white peers are getting the latitude to be able to do that, and they're not.
And another thing that's really important about what Dwayne and Mark are saying is that there is a significant connection to the amount of educational attainment that you receive and your health outcomes. We know that across a number of predictors of health outcomes, educational attainment is a solid, a consistent correlate of having better health. And so when you push boys out of school before their time, or they get suspended or get derailed on the educational track, it also has significant effects on how well they live and under what kind of health status or conditions they live.
What are some of the health outcomes, just in terms of feeling, knowing that you're being profiled, knowing that you're being singled out and treated differently? Wisdom Powell, do we know? Are these similar to post-traumatic stress? What are the emotional outcomes?
So one solid outcome that we know is connected to this kind of quotidian exposure is depression. And the interesting thing about depression among blacks in general, but particularly among black men, is that it's something that they don't talk about, but we know exists, because we see this paradoxical finding where we have, you know, lower rates of depression but higher rates of suicide completion. So there is something happening sort of psychologically as a consequence of these kinds of exposures. And what we're trying to understand now is, how do we get men to overcome this idea of masculinity that keeps them sort of, you know, tight-lipped about the exposures that they have, so that we can intervene in them in a more timely manner, while at the same time pushing structures and systems to reduce the amount of the exposure? Because we can't stop just with helping men to feel better about the racism they are exposed to. We have to also shift the systems.
Or empowered to talk about it. Dwayne Betts, your gift is literature and expression. Has it helped you? Well, let me start earlier. Was it difficult for you? You heard Wisdom Powell say African-American men in general, are less likely to talk about these things and suffer the depression. Was it hard for you to talk out loud about this thing, to express yourself?
I've written 3 books and I have never said the word depression in public. You know, like I've never, I mean, I went to prison at 16 and I've actually never discussed really what it means to be in prison at 16. And I think, you know, one of the things that happens is that your experience is you're just sort of so dumbfounded by your experience that I think for me, I feel like, you know, at certain levels, and if I talk about it, I'm either making excuses or I just don't deserve the level of concern that I would get because, like, I'm at Yale Law School. And I recognize that the only reason that I can speak about these things is because I'm at Yale Law School. You know, if I wasn't at Yale Law School and I was just raising my sons and living with my wife and working at wherever, like, I wouldn't even have a platform for somebody to say that, you know, these experiences that you have matter and say something about the system beyond saying something about the mistakes and the decisions that you made. And so me being aware of that is probably another reason why, you know, despite having a platform, despite having the ability to write and to communicate, like, I don't see a therapist. I've never seen a therapist. And I wouldn't even begin to understand how to frame, you know, that conversation.
I wonder, we've talked about your poetry, and I wonder if I could ask you to read a poem for us now.
Sure. For the city that nearly broke me. A woman tattoos Malik's name above her breast and talks about the conspiracy to destroy blacks. This is all a fancy way to say that someone kirked out, emptied 5 or 6 or 7 shots into a still warm body. No indictment follows Malik's death, follows smoke running from a fired pistol. An old quarrel, crimson against concrete and the officer's gun still smoking. Someone says the people need to stand up, that the system's a glass house falling on only a few heads. This and the stop stitching ads are the conundrum. And man, what about all that blood? All those closed eyes imagining Malik's killer forever callful to a series of sales. And you almost believe them. You do. Except the cognac in your hand is an old habit. A toast of friends buried before the daybreak of their old age. You know the truth of the talking, of the quarrels, and how history lets the blame go blameless for the blood that flows black in the street. You imagine there's a riot going on and someone is tossing a trash can through Sal's window, calling that revolution. While behind us, cell doors keep clanking closed and Malik's casket door clanks closed and the bodies that roll off the block and into the prisons and into the ground keep rolling. And no one will admit that this is the way America strangles itself.
Ardwayne Betts reading the poem For the City That Nearly Broke Me. And you have said over and over again, you almost are reluctant to talk about this because you don't want it to sound like an excuse. And yet there are clearly these very different experiences of what it means to be African-American in this country. And it's something you express clearly. Is that something you think is true, that there's just a big divide between what it means to live in those communities and what it means to read about it in the paper when we read about Ferguson and other places?
You know, I mean, it's a fundamental difference between what it means to read about it and what it means to live it. And I mean, the difference is sort of the difference between life and death and the difference between having a function in life and sort of imagining what that means. And maybe that's only on the margins, but I think it's so many people who just don't get an opportunity. I just know a lot of people who aren't free, who are in prison, who will never get an opportunity to come home to raise children. And so it's hard for me to even imagine that the public discourse that we have around these issues even pretend to touch that pain.
Yeah, Mark, go ahead. Please finish.
No, that was it. I mean, sometimes I wish it did, and sometimes I imagine it like this conversation approaches it. But I think the wound is so raw that we're actually afraid to think about what it actually means to consider the kind of changes we would need to prevent this from happening going forth.
Mark Anthony, you say this gets reflected too in media coverage of places like Ferguson and North Charleston, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we simply do not, news media at least, doesn't provide any kind of context to understand the everyday lives of folks who live in these communities. When you deal with the over-incarceration, the over-prosecuting, you know, for what are essentially the crime of being impoverished, the crime of being poor, the crime of not having a job, and then you know, that reality is undermined by, you know, bad school systems that are not invested in turning black kids into thinkers. And that's not accidental, right? Why would this society be interested in having young black and brown kids actually be critical thinkers? Because then they would be able to connect the dots, and that would be much more of a problem.
Well, Dwayne, that's what you got suspended for, right? Critical thinking. And it came out your mouth, and so they decided that you'd be better off outside this school than inside creating the critique. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just imagine if one of those teachers expected me to be a Yale law student. You know, my whole life would be profoundly different if a single teacher actually thought that it was a likelihood, a possibility, no matter how remote, that I would be a Yale law student.
It just strikes me that listening to Dwayne's really powerful testimony about his life, of how we use the term missing, but really these men and boys are invisible. And the question I always ask, if they're missing, who's searching for them? Are we searching for them? And if we are, what through what lens and to what end are we doing that? I think that when Mark was talking about why wouldn't we want them to be critical thinkers, well, because we're hemorrhaging talent in this nation
by not paying attention
to the needs of this huge part of our population who are creative thinkers, who are like Dwayne, have the capacity to think critically, to express himself through words, and now will be a part of the criminal justice approach or social justice movement from a more formal position. Think of how many Dwaynes there are that we are not reaching, and because we haven't been searching for them.
I mean, when you think about the success of a show like The Wire and like Stringer Bell, I mean, the reality is that this is a guy who could have been at Wharton, who could have been at Tuck School, right? And yes, it's a fiction about what was happening in Baltimore, but we know those guys, right? We know those cats who were brilliant on the streets, just being able to think off their dome. But it was not, you know, focused on when they were in institutional environments where they could have taken advantage of being in these educational systems.
Mark Anthony Neal, a professor of African and African American Studies at Duke. Wisdom Powell, professor of health behavior at UNC School of Public Health. And Dwayne Betts, a law student at Yale University. He's written several books, including A Question of Freedom. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we're going to take a look at the state of investigative journalism. We'll do it on the State of Things. Please stay tuned.